I'm glad that the ice was broken about the twins. I have a twin story also. I certainly hope they don't think we mean any disrespect, but they're just the twins. Well, when I first came here, they were little bitty, you know, very, very young. And I couldn't tell them apart. And so I worked very diligently to learn their facial features so I could tell them apart. And over the years, sometimes they would have growth spurts at different times. Danielle was much taller, and then Daisy almost caught her. But I thought, I really am comfortable knowing those girls apart. And then Danielle was working one night, and her boyfriend came and was sitting by Daisy. So what do? I call Daisy Danielle. So they threw me off. I'm going to have to learn that again now. One last thing, and then we'll get into our lesson. But I've been working so hard to lose weight and get my blood sugar under control. And then one of my best friends talks about ice cream and hot fudge and whipped cream and a cherry on top. Oh, goodness, with friends like that. Ultimately, our lesson, well, it's not going to be humorous at all, so I guess we can get all of that out of our system. The title of my lesson tonight is Jesus, the Man of Sorrows. Ultimately, we're going to be reading from Matthew chapter 26, but as I like to do, I want to back up to Matthew chapter 24 and springboard into our lesson. Now, Matthew chapter 26 is really the culmination of some of Jesus's most emphatic and most dynamic and really most important teaching, especially for the apostles. If you remember back in chapter 24, Jesus leaves the Mount of leaves the temple. No, I apologize. We're still in Matthew 26. But Jesus leaves the temple, goes to the Mount of Olives, that is back in chapter 24. There he begins to teach the disciples some very important things. He talks about religious deceit and religious corruption. He talks about wars and rumors of wars. He implies teaching about famine, pestilence, and earthquake. We are in Matthew 24, verse 8. These are the beginning of sorrows. So Jesus has introduced the concept of sorrow, not only for himself, not only for the disciples, but for all Christians at that time, or all of his disciples. And then he goes on to talk about false prophets and scribes and Pharisees and iniquity abounding. We're still in Matthew 24, verse 13. He that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. And this, as we know, is a partial listing of signs of something to come. Now, I have no idea what percentage, but I would say a larger percentage than not of preachers in the 21st century using the broad umbrella of Christianity would stand before you tonight and say, these are the signs of the second coming. These are the signs of the end of the world. Wars and rumors of war and starvation and pestilence and all of these terrible things. The destruction of the world is at hand. But brethren, if you and I are diligent in our Bible study, if we're diligent in studying Matthew 24, we realize Jesus is not talking about the end of the world. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Verse 16, when you see these things happen in Judea, when those disciples see those things happening around Jerusalem, escape to the mountains. And then he says in verse 34, this generation shall not pass away till all these things shall be fulfilled. That's the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And then Jesus begins to talk about the second coming. Now, brethren, it is a strong possibility, maybe even a probability, that we need to talk more about the second coming of Jesus. And maybe the reason you and I need to talk more about the second coming is because there is so much confusion in that area in the religious community. Jesus mentions the second coming. Look at verse 42. Watch therefore, for you do not know the hour our Lord cometh. That's the second coming. He's not talking about signs of earthquake, pestilence, famine, wars and rumors of wars concerning his second coming, because if he was, we would see those things happening in more abundance, and we would say Jesus is about to come. But Peter says when Jesus comes, it will be a surprise. Two men will be working in the same field. One will be ready and one will not. Two men will be asleep in the same house. One will be ready and one will not. The obvious teaching of Jesus is we need to be ready at all times, because we just do not know. There are no signs concerning the second coming. Then we get into Matthew 25, and Jesus tells some parables that enforce his teaching. Now we've gotten to Matthew chapter 26. Brethren, for the most part, when the gospel paints for us a mental picture of Jesus, we see a sweet, kind, compassionate young man. I say young man, he was only 31, 32, 33 during his ministry. But in Matthew chapter 26, Jesus doesn't erase that picture, but he also adds the fact that he is a man of sorrows. Now notice the time frame of Matthew chapter 26. 2 days before the Passover. 2 days before Jesus would be betrayed by Judas. 2 days before this arrest and trial and ultimate crucifixion would take place. Jesus certainly was a man of sorrows. Why? Because Jesus knew what was coming. I think sometimes we don't even realize this. This was not a surprise to Jesus. Jesus knew exactly what was coming. Do you remember when the lady poured the precious oil on him and some criticized that money could have been spent elsewhere? He said, "Leave her alone. She's preparing me for my burial." Jesus knew exactly what is coming. Now that's the direction I want us to consider in the lesson tonight. Jesus is a man of sorrows. Our text actually begins in verse 37, Matthew 26, 37 and following. And Jesus took with him, once again, Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, Peter, James, and John, and began to be sorrowful and very heavy, heavy of heart. His heart is breaking. Then Jesus says to Peter, James, and John, that inner circle, "My soul, my essence is exceeding sorrowful, even to the point of death. Tarry with me, stay with me, and watch with me." And he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt." Not my will, but your will be done. Now, brethren, we don't know why Jesus from time to time would isolate himself with Peter, James, and John, but he did. I feel that history is probably right, traditional history. Those three men assumed very strong leadership in the early church. They were all apostles. We know that some of them even became elders of the church in Jerusalem. So that's probably why he chose these particular men. But he chooses these men and he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. That appears to be one of Jesus' favorite places to go. It's there on the outside of Jerusalem. And he isolates himself from them because he's very upset. Maybe that's why he pulled himself away from the rest of the apostles. We're not told, but he isolates himself and he acknowledges to these men that his soul is sorrowful, his heart is breaking even to the point of death. And what does he need? He needs their comfort. And that's why he says, "Watch with me." And then the Bible says he went even a little further into the garden. He isolated himself even from Peter, James, and John. And he fell down on his face and he prayed, "Father, if there is some other way, let's choose that other way. But if this is the way that you choose, this is the way it will be." Now, brethren, I'm certainly not trying to compare my life to Jesus's or my times of sorrow with his, not in any way. But I know, speaking personally, when I am really hurting emotionally, I don't want to be alone. I can remember several times just asking Linda, just sit on the bed with me. You don't even have to talk to me. Just sit there and let me lay here. You don't even have to say anything. In fact, I probably don't want her to say anything. I just don't want to be alone. Jesus just didn't want to be alone. He needed them. He wanted them. He wanted Peter, James, and John to help him emotionally. And in this state of extreme emotional unrest, and maybe especially because he did not get that comfort from Peter, James, and John, they fell asleep. He asked the Father for comfort. Father, if there is any other way than the cross, let's use that other way. If there's another way to secure salvation for my disciples, let's use that way. If there's any other choice, let's choose that any other choice. But not my will, not what I want, but what you want. Now, why was he so distressed? Why was he a man of sorrow? Well, he not only understood what was about to happen, he understood what was going to happen. You know, sometimes we talk about having a bad day. Can't even use that phraseology with Jesus on this day. Earlier that same evening, he said, I want to tell you the truth. One of you, one of my 12 best friends, is going to betray me. And we know that Judas did. And then he also told the rest of them, this very night, every one of you is going to run away. You're going to leave me. You're going to abandon me. And that's exactly what happened. They did run away. They did abandon him, fearing for their own lives. And I don't really blame them. But that's why Jesus felt this sorrow. He knew what was going to happen, and he knew exactly how it was going to happen. He knew he was going to be crucified. Let's talk about the crucifixion for just a moment. The Romans devised the crucifixion to be the cruelest death ever. They wanted it to be such a cruel way to die, a torturous way to die. They wanted to instill fear in the people that they were dominating, and it worked. In fact, there is a word that has come to our vocabulary that was designed strictly to talk about the pain that someone suffered on the cross. Excruciation, or excruciating. We talk about a headache being an excruciating pain. That was a word that described death on the cross. That's why Jesus was a man of sorrow. It was designed to be humiliating. It was designed to be painful. And it was designed to last the longest amount of time possible. He knew what was going to happen. He knew exactly what was going to happen. I too would fall on my face and say, Father, if there's another way, let's find that other way. Now, Luke even reminds us in Luke 22 that when he was in this intense prayer, that the sweat on his brow, I don't remember if it said brow, but the sweat was dripping off of him like great drops of blood. I've heard preachers say that maybe there was blood oozing out of his pores. Not at all, but he was sweating profusely because of all of this. And that's where the ultimate conflict took place. Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. The human side of Jesus just didn't want to go through that, but the divine side of Jesus realized he had to. Jesus, the man, did not want to die on the cross, but Jesus, the Son of God, realized that that was what God designed and that is what he had to do. And in total honesty, we need to say, Jesus didn't want to die, but he had to die. And we don't begrudge him of that. I remember one time reading an article. It really wasn't that long ago, otherwise I wouldn't remember it. But I read an article one time where the author said Jesus didn't really want to die. And I thought for a moment, yes, he really did want to die. But no, he really didn't. He really did because that was the will of the Father. But he really didn't because he was a man. Now, I don't know the specifics of what was on Jesus' mind at that time. Sometimes we say, well, he knew the nails were going to be driven into his hands and feet. I really don't believe that's what it was on his mind. You know what I think was on his mind? Me and you and everyone else that he died to save. He took the totality of human sins. That's what he took to the cross. That's why he's a man of sorrows. Maybe he was even remembering what Isaiah, the messianic prophet, said. He, that's talking about Jesus, was wounded for our transgression. He was bruised for our iniquities. Chastised for our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord, that's God, hath laid on him, that's Jesus, the iniquity of us all. And Jesus prayed from the cross, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Once again, he was thinking about us. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. He carried the weight of the sins of the whole world on his shoulders. And brethren, let's be honest, it was because of us. It was because of us. Now, in spite of it all, we see his submission. Not my will, but thine. Now, Luke gives the time frame that Matthew actually does not. He says that during this time of fervent prayer, this is Luke 22, 43, there appeared an angel to Jesus from heaven, strengthening him. You know, that's one of the most beautiful things. And I think we fail to mention that. God sent an angel from heaven. The angel comforted him. What Jesus needed, he received from the Father. And that's why I'm preaching this lesson right now. Because Jesus received from the Father what he needed during a time of sorrow, and we will receive from the Father what we need in any time of sorrow. When we need strength, God will provide that strength for us. When we need encouragement, God will provide that encouragement for us. He's always just a prayer away. And we need to take advantage of that. Now, after that time of intimate prayer, what did Jesus do? He went back to Peter, James, and John. First of all, he said, just sleep on. You know, you need your rest. Then he said, no, let's get up. There are things that need to take place. That is spoken with great determination, with great resolve. He was going to the cross to secure our salvation. And we do know what happened next. Judas led that mob of soldiers up. He planted that hypocritical kiss on Jesus' face. Jesus was taken. Everyone ran away. He was arrested. He was taken before Caiaphas and then Annas, ultimately before Pilate, and then back and forth. Finally, he was crucified. But remember what Jesus had already said. Therefore doth the Father love me because I lay down my life that I might take it up again. No man can convince me to do this. I do it of my own volition. As my Father gives commandment, so I do. And of course, I paraphrase that. You know, I've heard preachers over the years say that the battle for our soul was the cross. I believe that's part of it. Or they'll say the battle for our souls was at the resurrection. I believe that's part of it. Maybe even they would say the battle for our souls is the ascension. Brethren, I believe the battle for our souls was won in the garden when Jesus said, not my will, but thine be done. So Jesus was a man of great sorrow. And it causes us to be filled with sorrow when we realize all that transpired in his life for us. But at the same time, it gives us such peace and comfort, knowing not only how much Jesus loves us, but how much the Father loves us. to give the Spirit charge to inspire these men so that we have a complete and accurate record of how to get to heaven. He designed the church, Jesus' body, to give us that comfort and strength that we need. And he's given us an avenue of communication called prayer. And we need to use it all the time. A tremendous struggle in Jesus' life, but he won. Therefore, we will be winners as well. Perhaps tonight there's someone who is struggling and needs prayers for comfort, strength, encouragement. Perhaps there's someone here that needs to be baptized for the remission of sins. Whatever the case may be, if you need to respond, please do.